Chapter 7. Of speaking to her, his quickness in catching her meaning, his evident eagerness to prolong their excursions, and to seize on every chance of being with her. The signs of his liking were manifest enough, but it was hard to guess how much they meant, because his manner was so different from anything North Dormer had ever shown her. He was at once simpler and more deferential than anyone else he had known. And sometimes it was just when he was simplest that she most felt the distance between them. Education and opportunity had divided them by a width that no effort of hers could bridge, and even when his youth and his admiration brought him nearest, some chance word, some unconscious allusion, seemed to thrust her back across the gulf. Never had it yawned so wide as when she fled up to her room carrying with her the echo of Mr. Royal's tale. Her first confused thought was the prayer that she might never see young Arnie again. It was too bitter to picture him as the detached impartial listener to such a story. Wish he'd go away. I wish he'd go tomorrow, and never come back, she moaned to her pillow, and far into the night she lay there, in the disordered dresses he had forgotten to take off, her whole soul a tossing misery on which her hopes and dreams spun about like drowning straws. Of all this tumult only a vague heart soreness was left when she opened her eyes the next morning. Her first thought was of the weather, for Arnie had asked her to take him to the brown house under Porcupine, and then around by Hamblin, and as the trip was a long one they were to start at 9. The sun rose without a cloud, and earlier than usual she was in the kitchen, making cheese sandwiches, decanting buttermilk into a bottle, wrapping up slices of apple pie, and accusing Verena of having given away a basket she needed, which had always hung on a hook in the passage. When she came out into the porch, in her pink calico, which had run a little in the washing, but was still bright enough, to set off her dark tints, as he had such a triumphant sense of being a part of the sunlight and the morning, that the last trace of her misery vanished. What did it matter where she came from, or whose child she was, when love was dancing in her veins, and down the road she saw young Arnie coming toward her? Mr. Royal was in the porch too. He had said nothing at breakfast, but when she came out in her pink dress, the basket in her hand, he looked at her with surprise. Where are you going to? He asked. Why, Mr. Arnie's starting earlier than usual today, she answered. Mr. Arnie, Mr. Arnie? Ain't Mr. Arnie learned how to drive a horse yet? She made no answer, and he sat tilted back in his chair, drumming on the rail of the porch. It was the first time he had ever spoken of the young man in that tone, and Charity felt a faint chill of apprehension. After a moment he stood up, and walked away toward the bit of ground behind the house, where the hired man was hoeing. The air was cool and clear, with the autumnal sparkle that a north wind brings to the hills in early summer, and the night had been so still that the dew hung on everything, not as a lingering moisture, but in separate beads that glittered like diamonds on the ferns and grasses. It was a long drive to the foot of Porcupine. First across the valley, with blue hills bounding the open slopes, then down into the beech woods, following the course of the Creston, a brown brook leaping over velvet ledges, then out again onto the farm lands about Creston Lake, and gradually up the ridges of the Eagle Range. At last they reached the yoke of the hills, and before them opened another valley, green and wild, and beyond it more blue heights eddying away to the sky like the waves of a receding tide. Arnie tied the horse to a tree stump, and they unpacked their basket under an aged walnut with a riven trunk out of which bumblebees darted. The sun had grown hot, and behind them was the noonday murmur of the forest. Summer insects danced on the air, and a flock of white butterflies fanned the mobile tips of the crimson fireweed. In the valley below not a house was visible. It seemed as if Charity Royal and young Arnie were the only living beings in the great hollow of earth and sky. Charity's spirits flagged and disquieting thoughts stole back on her. Young Arnie had grown silent, and as he lay beside her, his arms under his head, his eyes on the network of leaves above him, she wondered if he were musing on what Mr. Royal had told him, and if it had really debased her in his thoughts. She wished he had not asked her to take him that day to the brown house. She did not want him to see the people she came from while the story of her birth was fresh in his mind. More than once as he had been on the point of suggesting that they should follow the ridge and drive straight to Amblin, where there was a little deserted house he wanted to see, but shyness and pride held her back. "He'd better know what kind of folks I belong to," she said to herself, with a somewhat forced defiance, for in reality it was shame that kept her silent. Suddenly she lifted her hand and pointed to the sky. "There's a storm coming up." He followed her glance and smiled. "Is it that scrap of cloud among the pines that frightens you? It's over the mountain, and a cloud over the mountain always means trouble. Oh, I don't believe half the bad things you all say of the mountain. But anyhow, we'll get down to the brown house before the rain comes." He was not far wrong, for only a few isolated drops had fallen when they turned into the road under the shaggy flank of Porcupine and came upon the brown house. It stood alone beside a swamp bordered with alder thickets and tall bulrushes. Not another dwelling was in sight, and it was hard to guess what motive could have actuated the early settler who had made his home in so unfriendly a spot. Charity had picked up enough of her companion's erudition to understand what had attracted him to the house. She noticed the fan-shaped tracery of the broken light above the door, the flutings of the paintless pilasters at the corners, and the round window set in the gable. And she knew that, for reasons that still escaped her, these were things to be admired and recorded. Still, they had seen other houses far more epical. The word was Arnie's, and as he threw the reins on the horse's neck he said with a slight shiver of repugnance, "He won't stay long." Against the restless alders turning their white lining to the storm, the house looked singularly desolate. The paint was almost gone from the clapboards, the window panes were broken and patched with rags, and the garden was a poisonous tangle of nettles, burdocks and tall swamp weeds over which big blue bottles hummed. At the sound of wheels, a child with a towhead and pale eyes like Liff Hyatt's peered over the fence, and then slipped away behind an outhouse. Harney jumped down and helped Charity out, and as he did, so the rain broke on them. It came slantwise, on a furious gale, laying shrubs and young trees flat, tearing off their leaves like an autumn storm, turning the road into a river, and making hissing pools of every hollow. Thunder rolled incessantly through the roar of the rain, and a strange glitter of light ran along the ground under the increasing blackness. "Lucky we're here after all," Harney laughed. He fastened the horse under a half-roofless shed, and wrapping Charity in his coat ran with her to the house. The boy had not reappeared, and as there was no response to their knocks, Harney turned the door handle, and they went in. There were three people in the kitchen to which the door admitted them. An old woman with a handkerchief over her head was sitting by the window. She held a sickly-looking kitten on her knees, and whenever it jumped down and tried to limp away, she stooped and lifted it back without any change of her aged, unnoticing face. Another woman, the unkempt creature that Charity had once noticed in driving by, stood leaning against the window frame and stared at them, and near the stove an unshaved man in a tattered shirt sat on a barrel asleep. The place was bare and miserable, and the air heavy with the smell of dirt and stale tobacco. Charity's heart sank. Old derided tales of the mountain people came back to her, and the woman's stare was so disconcerting, and the face of the sleeping man so sodden and bestial, that her disgust was tinged with a vague dread. She was not afraid for herself. She knew the Hyatts would not be likely to trouble her, but she was not sure how they would treat a mighty fellow. Lucius Harney would certainly have laughed at her fears. He glanced about the room, uttered a general, "How are you?" to which no one responded, and then asked the younger woman if they might take shelter till the storm was over. She turned her eyes away from him and looked at Charity. "You're the girl from Royals, ain't you?" The color rose in Charity's face. "Charity Royal," she said, as if asserting her right to the name in the very place where it might have been most open to question. The woman did not seem to notice. "Who can stay?" she merely said. Then she turned away and stooped over a dish in which she was stirring something. Harney and Charity sat down on a bench made of a board resting on two starch boxes. They faced a door hanging on a broken hinge, and through the crack they saw the eyes of the tow-headed boy and of a pale little girl with a scar across her cheek. Charity smiled and signed to the children to come in, but as soon as they saw they were discovered, they slipped away on bare feet. It occurred to her that they were afraid of rousing the sleeping man, and probably the woman shared their fear, for she moved about as noiselessly and avoided going near the stove. The rain continued to beat against the house, and in one or two places it sent a stream through the patched panes and ran in two pools on the floor. Every now and then the kitten mewed and struggled down, and the old woman stooped and caught it, holding it tight in her bony hands. And once or twice the man on the barrel half woke, changed his position and dozed again, his head falling forward on his hairy breast. As the minutes passed, and the rain still streamed against the windows, a loathing of the place and the people came over Charity. The sight of the weak-minded old woman, of the cowed children, and the ragged man sleeping off his liquor, made the setting of her own life seem a vision of peace and plenty. She thought of the kitchen at Mr. Royal's, with its scrubbed floor and dresser full of china, and the peculiar smell of yeast and coffee and soft soap, that as he had always hated, but that now seemed the very symbol of household order. She saw Mr. Royal's room, with the high-backed horsehair chair, the faded rag carpet, the row of books on a shelf, the engraving of The Surrender of Burgoyne over the stove, and the mat with a brown and white spaniel on a moss-green border. And then her mind traveled to Miss Hatchard's house, where all was freshness, purity and fragrance, and compared to which the red house had always seemed so poor and plain. "This is where I belong, this is where I belong," she kept repeating to herself, but the words had no meaning for her. Every instinct and habit made her a stranger among these poor swamp people living like vermin in their lair. With all her soul she wished as he had not yielded to Harney's curiosity and brought him there. The rain had drenched her, and she began to shiver under the thin folds of her dress. The younger woman must have noticed it, for she went out of the room and came back with a broken teacup which she offered to Charity. It was half full of whiskey, and Charity shook her head, but Harney took the cup and put his lips to it. When he had set it down, Charity saw him feel in his pocket and draw out a dollar. He hesitated a moment, and then put it back, and she guessed that he did not wish her to see him offering money to people as he had spoken of as being her kin. The sleeping man stirred, lifted his head, and opened his eyes. They rested vacantly for a moment on Charity and Harney, and then closed again, and his head drooped, but a look of anxiety came into the woman's face. She glanced out of the window, and then came up to Harney. "Guess you better go along now," she said. The young man understood, and got to his feet. "Thank you," he said, holding out his hand. She seemed not to notice the gesture, and turned away as they opened the door. The rain was still coming down, but they hardly noticed it. The pure air was like balm in their faces. The clouds were rising and breaking, and between their edges the light streamed down from remote blue hollows. Harney untied the horse, and they drove off through the diminishing rain, which was already beaded with sunlight. For a while Charity was silent, and her companion did not speak. She looked timidly at his profile. It was graver than usual, as though he too were oppressed by what they had seen. Then she broke out abruptly. "Those people back there are the kind of folks I come from. They may be my relations, for all I know." She Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.